Chapter 29. I was frightened out of it at last by an experience of Dr. A's. He was a sort of Nansen of that day. He had been to the North Pole, and it made him celebrated. He had even seen the polar bear climb the pole. He had made one of those magnificent voyages such as Nansen made, and in those days, when a man did anything which greatly distinguished him for the moment, he had to come onto the lecture platform and tell all about it. Dr. Hayes was a great, magnificent creature like Nansen, superbly built. He was to appear in Boston. He wrote his lecture out, and it was his purpose to read it from manuscript. But in an evil hour he concluded that it would be a good thing to preface it with something rather handsome, poetical, and beautiful that he could get off by heart and deliver, as if it were the thought of the moment. He had not had my experience, and could not do that. He came on the platform, held his manuscript down, and began with a beautiful piece of oratory. He spoke something like this. When a lonely human being, a pygmy in the midst of the architecture of nature, stands solitary on those icy waters and looks abroad to the horizon, and sees mighty castles and temples of eternal ice raising up their pinnacles tipped by the pencil of the departing sun, here a man came across the platform, and touched him on the shoulder, and said, colon 1 minute, and then to the audience, is Mrs. John Smith in the house? Her husband has slipped on the ice, and broken his leg. And you could see the Mrs. John Smiths get up everywhere, and drift out of the house, and it made great gaps everywhere. Then Dr. Hayes began again, colon when a lonely man, a pygmy in the architecture, the janitor came in again, and shouted, colon it is not Mrs. John Smith. It is Mrs. John Jones. Then all the Mrs. Jones got up and left. Once more the speaker started, and was in the midst of the sentence, when he was interrupted again, and the result was that the lecture was not delivered. But the lecturer interviewed the janitor afterward in a private room, and of the fragments of the janitor they took 12 baskets full. Now, I don't want to sit down just in this way. I have been talking with so much levity that I have said no serious thing, and you are really no better or wiser, although Robert Buchanan has suggested that I am a person who deals in wisdom. I have said nothing which would make you better than when you came here. I should be sorry to sit down without having said one serious word which you can carry home and relate to your children and the old people who are not able to get away. And this is just a little maxim which has saved me from many a difficulty and many a disaster, and in times of tribulation and uncertainty has come to my rescue, as it shall to yours, if you observe it as I do day and night. I always use it in an emergency, and you can take it home as a legacy from me, and it is pen in doubt, tell the truth. The Ascot Gold Cup, the news of Mr. Cleeman's arrival in England in June, 1907, was announced in the papers with big headlines. Immediately following the announcement was the news also with big headlines that the Ascot Gold Cup had been stolen the same day. The combination, Mark Twain arrives Ascot Cup stolen, amused the public. The Lord Mayor of London gave a banquet at the Mansion House in honor of Mr. Cleeman's. I do assure you that I am not so dishonest as I look. I have been so busy trying to rehabilitate my honor about that Ascot Cup that I have had no time to prepare a speech. I was not so honest in former days as I am now, but I have always been reasonably honest. Well, you know how a man is influenced by his surroundings. Once upon a time I went to a public meeting, where the oratory of a charitable worker so worked on my feelings that, in common with others, I would have dropped something substantial in the hat if it had come round at that moment. The speaker had the power of putting those vivid pictures before one. We were all affected. That was the moment for the hat. I would have put $200 in. Before he had finished, I could have put in $400. I felt I could have filled up a blank check with somebody else's name and dropped it in. Well, now, another speaker got up, and in 15 minutes damped my spirit, And during the speech of the third speaker, all my enthusiasm went away. When at last the hat came round, I dropped in 10 cents and took out 25. I came over here to get the honorary degree from Oxford, and I would have encompassed the seven seas for an honor like that, the greatest honor that has ever fallen to my share. I am grateful to Oxford for conferring that honor upon me, and I am sure my country appreciates it, because first and foremost it is an honor to my country. And now I am going home again across the sea. I am in spirit young, but in the flesh old, so that it is unlikely that when I go away I shall ever see England again. But I shall go with the recollection of the generous and kindly welcome I have had. I suppose I must say goodbye. I say it not with my lips only, but from the heart. The Savage Club Dinner, a portrait of Mr. Clemens, signed by all the members of the club attending the dinner, was presented to him, July 6, 1907, and in submitting the toasty health of Mark Twain, Mr. J. Scott Stokes recalled the fact that he had read parts of Dr. Clemens' works to Harold Frederick during Frederick's last illness. Mr. Chairman and fellow savages, I am very glad indeed to have that portrait. I think it is the best one that I have ever had, and there have been opportunities before to get a good photograph. I have sat two photographers 22 times today. Those sittings added to those that have preceded them, since I have been in Europe, if we average at that rate, must have numbered 100 to 200 sittings. Out of all those, there ought to be some good photographs. This is the best I have had, and I am glad to have your honored names on it. I did not know Harold Frederick personally, but I have heard a great deal about him, and nothing that was not pleasant, and nothing except such things as lead a man to honor another man, and to love him. I consider that it is a misfortune of mine that I have never had the luck to meet him, and if any book of mine read to him in his last hours made those hours easier for him and more comfortable, I am very glad and proud of that. I call to mind such a case many years ago of an English authoress, well known in her day, who wrote such beautiful child tales, touching and lovely in every possible way. In a little biographical sketch of her, I found that her last hours were spent partly in reading a book of mine, until she was no longer able to read. That has always remained in my mind, and I have always cherished it as one of the good things of my life. I had read what S. he had written, and had loved her for what S. he had done. Stanley apparently carried a book of mine feloniously away to Africa, and I have not a doubt that it had a noble and uplifting influence there in the wilds of Africa, because on his previous journeys he never carried anything to read except Shakespeare and the Bible. I did not know of that circumstance. I did not know that he had carried a book of mine. I only noticed that, when he came back, he was a reformed man. I knew Stanley very well in those old days. Stanley was the first man who ever reported a lecture of mine, and that was in St. Louis. When I was down there the next time, to give the same lecture, I was told to give them something fresh, as they had read that in the papers. I met Stanley here, when he came back from that first expedition of his which closed with the finding of Livingston. You remember how he would break out at the meetings of the British Association, and find fault with what people said, because Stanley had notions of his own, and could not contain them. They had to come out, or break him up, and so he would go round and address geographical societies. He was always on the warpath in those days, and people always had to have Stanley contradicting their geography for them and improving it. But he always came back and sat drinking beer with me in the hotel up to 2 in the morning, and he was then one of the most civilized human beings that ever was. I saw in a newspaper this evening a reference to an interview which appeared in one of the papers the other day, in which the interviewer said that I characterized Mr. Burrell's speech the other day at the Pilgrims Club as ugly. Now, if you will excuse me, I never use slang to an interviewer or anybody else. That distresses me. Whatever I said about Mr. Burrell's speech was said in English, as good English as anybody uses. If I could not describe Mr. Burrell's delightful speech without using slang, I would not describe it at all. I would close my mouth, and keep it closed, much as it would discomfort me. Now that comes of interviewing a man in the first person, which is an altogether wrong way to interview him. It is entirely wrong, because none of you, I, or anybody else, could interview a man, could listen to a man talking any length of time, and then go off and reproduce that talk in the first person. It can't be done. What results is merely that the interviewer gives the substance of what is said, and puts it in his own language, and puts it in your mouth. It will always be either better language than you use or worse, and in my case it is always worse. I have a great respect for the English language. I am one of its supporters, its promoters, its elevators. I don't degrade it. A slip of the tongue would be the most that you would get from me. I have always tried hard and faithfully to improve my English and never to degrade it. I always try to use the best English to describe what I think and what I feel or what I don't feel and what I don't think. I am not one of those who in expressing opinions confine themselves to facts. I don't know anything that mars good literature so completely as too much truth. Facts contain a deal of poetry, but you can't use too many of them without damaging your literature. I love all literature, and as long as I am a doctor of literature, I have suggested to you for 20 years I have been diligently trying to improve my own literature, and now, by virtue of the University of Oxford, I mean to doctor everybody else's. Now I think I ought to apologize for my clothes. At home I venture things that I am not permitted by my family to venture in foreign parts. I was instructed, before I left home and ordered to refrain from white clothes in England. I meant to keep that command fair and clean, and I would have done it if I had been in the habit of obeying instructions, but I can't invent a new process in life right away. I have not had white clothes on since I crossed the ocean until now. In these 3 or 4 weeks I have grown so tired of gray and black that you have earned my gratitude in permitting me to come as I have. I wear white clothes in the depth of winter in my home, but I don't go out in the streets in them. I don't go out to attract too much attention. I like to attract some, and always I would like to be dressed so that I may be more conspicuous than anybody else. If I had been an ancient Briton, I would not have contented myself with blue paint, but I would have bankrupted the rainbow. I so enjoy gay clothes in which women clothe themselves, that it always grieves me when I go to the opera to see that, while women look like a flower bed, the men are a few gray stumps among them in their black evening dress. These are 2 or 3 reasons why I wish to wear white clothes. When I find myself in assemblies like this, with everybody in black clothes, I know I possess something that is superior to everybody else's. Clothes are never clean. You don't know whether they are clean or not, because you can't see. Here anywhere you must scour your head every 2 or 3 days, or it is full of grit. Your clothes must collect just as much dirt as your hair. If you wear white clothes you are clean, and your cleaning bill gets so heavy that you have to take care. I am proud to say that I can wear a white suit of clothes without a blemish for 3 days. If you need any further instruction in the matter of clothes I shall be glad to give it to you. I hope I have convinced some of you that it is just as well to wear white clothes as any other kind. I do not want to boast. I only want to make you understand that you are not clean. As to age, the fact that I am nearly 72 years old does not clearly indicate how old I am, because part of every day it is with me as with you. You try to describe your age, and you cannot do it. Sometimes you are only 15, sometimes you are 25. It is very seldom in a day that I am 72 years old. I am older now sometimes than I was when I used to rob orchards, a thing which I would not do today if the orchards were watched. I am so glad to be here to dash night. I am so glad to renew with the savages, that now ancient time, when I first sat with a company of this club in London in 1872. That is a long time ago. But I did stay with the savages a night in London long ago, and as I had come into a very strange land, and was with friends, as I could see, that has always remained in my mind as a peculiarly blessed evening, since it brought me into contact with men of my own kind and my own feelings. I am glad to be here, and to see you all again, because it is very likely that I shall not see you again. It is easier than I thought to come across the Atlantic. I have been received, as you know, in the most delightfully generous way in England ever, since I came here. It keeps me choked up all the time. Everybody is so generous, and they do seem to give you such a hearty welcome. Nobody in the world can appreciate it higher than I do. It did not wait till I got to London, but when I came ashore at Tilbury the stevedores on the dock raised the first welcome, a good and hearty welcome from the men who do the heavy labor in the world, and save you and me having to do it. They are the men who with their hands build empires, and make them prosper. It is because of them that the others are wealthy, and can live in luxury. They received me with a that went to my heart. They are the men that build civilization, and without them no civilization can be built. So I came first to the authors and creators of civilization, and I blessedly end this happy meeting with the savages who destroy it. General Miles and the dog, Mr. Clemens was the guest of honor at a dinner given by the Pleiades Club at the Hotel Brevoort, December 22, 1907. The toastmaster introduced the guest of the evening with a high tribute to his place in American literature, saying that he was dear to the hearts of all Americans. It is hard work to make a speech when you have listened to compliments from the powers in authority. A compliment is a hard text to preach to. When the chairman introduces me as a person of merit, and when he says pleasant things about me, I always feel like answering simply that what he says is true, that it is all right, that, as far as I am concerned, the things he said can stand as they are. But you always have to say something, and that is what frightens me. I remember out in Sydney once having to respond to some complimentary toast, and my one desire was to turn in my tracks like any other worm and run for it. I was remembering that occasion at a later date when I had to introduce a speaker, hoping then to spur his speech by putting him, in joke, on the defensive. I accused him in my introduction of everything I thought it impossible for him to have committed. When I finished there was an awful calm. I had been telling his life history by mistake. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.